Welcome to The Sharing Culture, the show that talks about sharing, who does it, why, the history, and a whole lot in between. I'm your host and executive director of Equal Giving Circle, AJ McCrary. Today, we're talking to Dr. Carmen Thompson, who is an author, a professor, an independent scholar, and just a really amazing human being. We have a book recommendation and a sharing activity for you today, so make sure that you listen all the way through. We're really excited to share with you. And welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Carmen, I'm going to read your bio.
Okay.
Because it is beautiful and impressive.
Okay.
And I want everybody listening to also get to get into this with us. So Carmen P. Thompson is a historian and the author of The Making of American Whiteness, The Formation of Race in the 17th Century Virginia. She earned her PhD in U.S. History from the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't sure. Yeah. And her Master's of Arts in African American Studies from Columbia University in New York. Dr. Thompson is a highly sought expert on race and whiteness in America. Her scholarship was quoted in December 2022 Oregon State Supreme Court decision, Watkins versus Ackley, in support of the court's conclusion of disparate racial impact of non-anonymous jury decision. She wrote the introduction to the forthcoming 2023 book, Protest City, Portland Summer of Rage, a photo book that chronicles the year-long protests in Portland, Oregon, after the murder of George Floyd by police in 2020. And she co-edited and authored articles in the peer-reviewed journal, Oregon Historical Quarterly, 2019 special issue on white supremacy in Oregon. She's held visiting scholar appointments at the Institute of Research in African American Studies at Columbia University in New York and in the Black Studies Department at Portland State University, and has taught a wide range of courses on the Black experience and whiteness at Portland State University and Portland Community College. I had the pleasure of being one of her students long time ago, and I can say that Dr. Carmen is one of the most incredible educators, and it is an honor to have you here on our podcast today.
Thank you very much. You're so kind.
Yeah. Super excited to ask you some questions.
Sure.
And also get into your book.
Of course.
So the first part of our podcast, we're going to ask you just some fun sort of warm-up questions. Yeah. There's no right or wrong answer.
Okay.
So what is your most favorite thing that anyone has shared with you?
Oh, wow. I would say the most favorite thing someone has shared with me is information about their faith and why it is that they choose to be a person of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And how that has informed how they live and be in the world.
Mm.
Interesting to understand, you know, what really moves a person that you think you know, family and friends, and then when they tell you something about the wholeness of who they are as a human being, more than just their name and just the usual stuff, but really, what is at the center and at the core of who they are as a person?
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Mm-hmm,
yeah. Mm-hmm. That definitely informs the way then you engage with said person afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. And just really kind of know where they're coming from, which a lot of times with friends or family, you know, is even if you know them for a long time, a lot of times it's superficial unless you kind of really, really know their backstory. But even then, you still kind of are really missing some of the depths of that. And then in their sharing, it opened me up to be able to feel like that I can reciprocate in that sharing and have a deeper conversation and kind of relate to them as humans in just a really more in-depth way.
Ooh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Yeah.
There's a little call to action in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
I love that like getting past the superficial and like slowing down enough to have those kinds of conversations, because it's like a lot of magic, a lot of care, a lot of growth happens.
For sure. I mean, and we still have those superficial conversations, but right. But I mean, when you really know somebody and kind of know where they're coming from, then it helps make sense. you know, sometimes even the superficial, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, just, and I really took joy in the fact that they felt comfortable enough to yeah. share that aspect of their personality and personhood with me. And like I said, because of that, that allowed, you know, helped me to feel comfortable in opening up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that way. You know, even though I usually tend to anyway after I know someone, but I really knew that this person trusted me mm-hmm. And felt comfortable with me, and that brought me joy.
I love that. It's mm-hmm. tapping into our humanity.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, my next question for you. What was the most meaningful thing that you've shared with somebody else?
You know, I think some of the meaningful things that I've shared with people, particularly around, you know, the book that we'll get into, but just, you know, as a child, you know, how it is that I came to the understanding of the world that I have now, and how I just kind of, on an intimate level, just kind of really, I've always had a sense of the world around me, even when I had not been able to express it. So the ability to be able to share with somebody, you know, what I'm about and why I do what I do. I think that's important, just like I was saying with the person who shared their faith with me that was close to me. I think it's also important that as I engage with people about topics of race and other issues kind of critical in our society, then sometimes people want to know, you know, kind of my grounding. And I feel comfortable in sharing that because one of the things that is important to me is just to be holistic in what I do within my scholarship. Within my work, my spiritual life, you know, it's just like one Carmen, and it all kind of revolves around, you know, the Black experience. And so I'd like to kind of, you know, tell people my grounding in that area.
That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So our last little rapid fire question mm-hmm. is, what do you share the most?
Within the context of that previous question?
Just in general. I mean, like, when I talk about this with my kid all the time, we talk about how much we share laughing.
Uh-huh.
Like, we love laughing. We're always laughing at our house.
Yeah.
So it could be in context to anything.
Yeah, I really think what I share the most is just, you know, because it's so important to who I am, just kind of my understanding of how I see kind of America's society and mm-hmm. social structure kind of working and set up, because it really kind of helps me understand the world that we live in. And so inevitably, as I'm talking to family and friends, you know, we'll obviously get into, you know, conversations just about how various sectors of our society is just messed up, right? Mm-hmm. And because of that, then I can interject like, okay, these social systems, these structures, these institutions have a history. And within the context of those histories, then I'm able to say, yeah, this is messed up. And, you know, here's kind of how these things happen in other ways. And it's likely within the context of that, I'm able to help share with them how it is that, you know, the situation that they're dealing with is of a similar context mm-hmm. and help them kind of see that these things that they're experiencing are not just kind of made up and not just an anomaly, but just kind of this organized way in which, you know, American society, capitalist societies kind of do what they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I feel really grateful that you're here to share a lot of your wisdom.
Thank you.
Because you're so wise and you know so many things. And the source pages, the bibliography, the source pages, the notes of this book definitely is proof that you know a lot, because you have read a lot to give us this incredible book.
I have.
I am curious, because you are not the average historian or mm-hmm. professor.
Mm-hmm.
And this is such an interesting word. What radicalized you?
That is an interesting word. Because I don't necessarily see what I'm doing as radical. Mm-hmm. I just see it kind of just as kind of aware.
Yep.
Conscious, raising consciousness. Mm-hmm. Which, like I was saying, I've kind of always had. And I don't know where that comes from because, you know, I'm a single mom. You know, my brother and I raised up here in the Portland area. So my mom was just kind of like, you know, everyday mom. She, you know, wasn't like, hey, Black Power this or, you know, stuff's messed up that. She didn't talk about the news. She just watched it for the weather. So it wasn't anything in my background or mm-hmm. in my home life that had that. It's just kind of, you know, who I am. But I started noticing at a very early age, even though before I was bused, and I'll get to that, but so I was bused in the third grade. But even before then, just as a, you know, kind of second or third grader, you know, I'm just thinking back, I kind of noticed that there was just differences in society between Black and white people in particular. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm still playing around and just being a kid, but I just kind of noticed it. Mm-hmm. And then I just thought, you know, that doesn't seem right or whatever. But, you know, you just go on with your normal everyday life. And, of course, you don't have the language or the way to express it. And then when I was bused, then clearly, you know, I was lived in Northeast Portland and then was bused out to the Lentz area. And so, you know, back then, Lentz isn't what it is today. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, just that whole process of, you know, kind of all the Black kids, you know, at Vernon School, where we used to catch the bus. Mm-hmm. And, of course, made a lot of friends there and still lifelong friends with people today from that experience and the bus ride. And then in the same way, you know, dealt with the white kids out there. There was, like, one Black family out there. And, of course, you know, we would fight and mm-hmm. be called the N-word. But we also were a lot friends, too. So, I mean, we went through that period and we would have our moments. But, you know, overall, you know, we kind of got along. I'd say 90% of it was fine. But in a lot of times when we did have problems, it was the older brothers and sisters mm-hmm. from Marshall High School who would come because that's where all the kids mm-hmm. in Lentz went to Marshall. And I never did go there. I was like, after the eighth grade, when I went from third to eighth out there, I'm like, there's no way I'm going to Marshall. But nonetheless, just
for all of Portland, where did you go to high school?
I went to Adams High School.
Okay.
Uh-huh, and then it closed at the end of my junior year. And then I went to Jefferson for my senior year.
Okay.
But I just kind of noticed, you know, just, okay, there's, you know, from Lentz to even where I was, there was a class difference. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the racial difference and just the, you know, being the N-word and just the hostility that would happen, you know, initially when we first went out there. And then sometimes with fights, like kids do fight, then mm-hmm. that, you know, the N-word would always come up. Even though, by and large, we did get along. I mean, like, I still like, you know, many of the people there, although I never see them anymore. So, you know, just the, noticing that social difference between the races at a young age, not understanding why, you know, some comments that teachers and things would make and just kind of not, you know, figuring it out. And so, I don't know, it's just kind of this instinctive, you know, awareness of that difference, even in my own neighborhood growing up in the Alberta neighborhood. It was mostly Black, but there were a lot of white kids, too. And we were all friends, you know, but my mother, you know, she had a lot of white friends. You know, I have an older brother. He had a lot of white friends. So I grew up in a mixed environment and they were all friends, you know, mm-hmm. but I just somehow was able to discern from the world around me that there was this difference. I didn't really mm-hmm. talk about it that much. I just kind of like saw it mm-hmm. and it was like, wow, you know. And then from there, as I got older, even as I was doing the same teenage, 20s stuff that everybody does, just when it came time for schoolwork or thought, those things would come back up. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of then began to inform, you know, who I was. So, yeah, it was really interesting. When I was at Adams High School, we had a great program there, but one of the teachers we had, and Adams was a different kind of high school. It was kind of modeled after a college. And so one of the teachers, Dave Mesereau, everybody there was like on a first name basis. Even today when I see some of the old teachers and I say, hey, Dave, you know, and they'll say, you went to Adams, didn't you? Because they don't do that at the, wherever they taught after that. But anyway, he used to tape episodes of 60 Minutes. And that was like when, you know, they'd be like catching, you know, business leaders in corruption and, and, you know, politicians doing corrupt things. And so we would have then these conversations about that.
What was going on?
And so added to that and being in this free thinking environment, critical thinking environment in high school, you know, really fit who I was as a person. Again, even as I was doing all the wild and crazy stuff that any teenager would do, but having that space within that school to be able to think critically and examine the world for what it was. And no matter what classroom you're in, you could be in a, you know, PE class, you could be, you know, in a science class. And if something happened on the news that was important, you could stop class and talk about that, even if it's on a totally different subject. I mean, anybody could. And that was the environment that I was in. Many people didn't like that. Friends of mine that I know now, it was like, it was just too, you know, open for me, you know, not enough structure. But for me, it was perfect. Yeah. And I think those kinds of experiences then, from the childhood awareness to going to kind of a high school that fostered critical thinking, just kind of added to who I naturally was. And it just kind of then went from there as I went on for to college and to graduate school, you know, so.
I love it. That's beautiful. And also a great example. Our kids see this. Our kids are, they understand, they might not have the language, but they understand what is going on.
They do.
I think that's something that a lot of folks, particularly white folks, need to understand, because our children are subjected and have to deal with, you know, anti-blackness and just racism in general at very young ages.
Very young ages.
Whereas, you know, many white people want to shield their children from that conversation, but your kids see it. They
And they do without even knowing. So just like me, you know, as a second and third grader, I saw it and, you know, didn't know what to do with it, but I knew that it was there. No one has to tell you these things, right? It, you just know. So no one utters a word, you know, I hate black people. You kind of know without anybody ever saying it explicitly like that.
I also very much was aware, because I would be around like my dad or my black family or my mother. And I would definitely be like, when we go to the store with mom, it's way different. If we're in the store with dad or my aunts, this
it's
is not
different.
This is not how you were talking the other day.
Exactly.
You know, this is definitely not the same treatment.
Yeah. So I'm sure you have that same type of awareness from seeing it kind of stark contrast in your day to day world. And so I was noticing the same thing. Even as I was being friends with the very people and in school with teachers and everybody, like I said, I wasn't like mad or angry or anything when these things were happening when I was growing up. I just noticed it.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, not knowing that it's kind of like really a part of who I am. Because, again, you're young. You don't know. You just kind of like, wow, that's whatever. And you just file it away and continue playing with your friends, you know. And but it's there.
It's there. Yeah, it is there. Well, that definitely gives us some great context and sort of a little bit of what inspires you in writing. I know you'd been teaching for quite some time before we got this incredible book, which I read it and I had to like stop myself from devouring it in a weekend. It's a really good book, The Making of American Whiteness, The Formation of Race in the 17th Century Virginia. And there are so many points in this book that I was like, ooh, I didn't think of it that way. One of the things that you lay out here that's really interesting to me is how close the making of Virginia was with religion.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes in our society, there's this, you know, separation of church and state, and we all see it and we're like, stop playing in our faces. But you lay this out very, very clearly. In terms of how both plantations were set up in connection to the churches and the other institutions, as well as who was in charge and why.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I want to get into the book.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
Well, I mean, keeping up with the context of my early childhood, musings, it really is trying to answer the question, why it was the European people decided to enslave Black people, and particularly in the United States. Why was it that white people and Black people were ranked differently in society, mm-hmm. with whites on top and Blacks on the bottom? Why were we chosen for slavery? Mm-hmm. What was it about Black people that we should be enslaved? I mean, no one had the answer for me. There's still no answer to that question in history books. My book is an attempt to kind of understand, mm-hmm. These earlier conversations that I was talking about, when I was in the second and third grade, kind of seeing these differences. This book is kind of addressing that. And religion is very much part of that. The church from the very beginning, long before settlement in Virginia in 1607, financed most exploration to the Americas. They were in connection with the governments, mm-hmm. In support of those explorers, those business people. So you had this institutional structure. You had the church, you had business, and governments, both, large, kind of, for lack of a better word, kind of national governments or state governments, and then local governments within that system from within the European context. You had all of them coming together to make that happen. So you already see the kind of systemic, mm-hmm. institutionalized way in which, white supremacy was able to express itself by who kind of sponsored and supported the expeditions, mm-hmm. From the beginning. I mean, yep. You can go back to antiquity. Yeah. And before, I'm just doing the American piece, but that's why I call it American whiteness. Uh-huh. There's a whole, you can go you can go a lot broader, internationally. And that's why I connected to the transatlantic slave, mm-hmm. trade, because from a business standpoint and exploration and religious standpoint, when it comes to American whiteness and then kind of this anti-Blackness, that's a excellent location to kind of see how all these systems worked and came to play upon the formation of, what is now the United States, in, mm-hmm. their settlement of the first colony that became the United States, part of the United States, which is Virginia in 1607.
Yeah.
I'm an early Americanist by training, and I was kind of forced to be to answer that question. I mean, when I went and got my PhD in U.S. history, I had no idea, what century, I'd be taken up. I'm like, okay, this is the question I want to, uh-huh. deal with. Okay, 20th century. Well, you can't get at the origins of race and white supremacy in the 20th, yeah. century. How about 19th? No. 18th? I said, let's just go from the beginning. And of course I had to even go before then, mm-hmm. to kind of come back,
yeah.
to 1607. But yeah, so I didn't start out that way, but you have to go back, and there's people that have done that work in antiquity. So, mm-hmm. for those of your listeners who are interested in really, really, really early history and antiquity and sooner, you see that.
Yeah. An interesting word that you say that we all say that we look in history as romanticized is explorer. And whenever I hear that word, I'm like, but really? Because that sounds really like wonderful and an adventure and, dare I say, healthy. But in reality, especially in this context, explorer is like a very fancy word for colonization.
It is. They're colonizers.
Yeah.
And I talk about that, just the term, mm-hmm. right? I mean, Columbus was a colonizer.
Yep.
The churches sponsored colonizing.
Yep.
Nations and governments sponsored colonizing. Shipbuilders, ship captains and workers, shipmates, all of those individuals that it took to sponsor these expeditions are colonizers.
Colonizers. Facts.
And I talk about in the book, you know, what does colonizing mean? What do you have to do to colonize a space?
Yes.
There's a lot of institutional work and inhumane work that has to be done by the colonizer. Mm-hmm. And so, and in that work, you learn what the colonizer is about.
Yep.
You know, so their actions. So just like I was saying before, in my work, there's no smoking gun. I hate Black people. Right. Mm-hmm. So, but you still have to like understand what was happening.
Yeah.
So in lieu of their words, I go by what they did. And that's their, that's telling me.
And you laid it out really clearly and beautifully. I mean, this is not a beautiful topic, but the way that you lay this information out is very thoughtful and very, like, it's interesting. And when you read the book, because I hope all of y'all read the book, you just kind of, as you keep going, you're like, I want to know more. I want to know more. Another thing that you lay out really well in this book, and I say well in terms of like, I'm speaking to people who are not used to necessarily reading like academic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The hierarchical system that enslaved folks were brought into.
Right.
Where oftentimes in today's context, people want to say, oh, well, my so-and-so was a indentured servant. And you really helped break down what that looked like and the difference and mm-hmm. how this, you know, other class of people sort of glob onto, mm-hmm. you know, the elites and mm-hmm. why.
Right. Yeah. There's a hierarchy of whiteness.
Yes.
And indentured servants was at the lowest level.
Mm-hmm.
And they depended upon that hierarchy. I mean, that was what they aspired to. That's how they understood their mm-hmm. difference, because just below them were who? Black people.
Yep.
Native Americans. Right. Mm-hmm. So they came over here, you know, they sold their labor as indentured servant, which mm-hmm. meant a contract that they would have, that they would say, okay, I'll come over here and sell my labor to you for X period of time. And in return for that, then I'll have the opportunity to own land and to do all of these wonderful things that, you know, all kinds of advertisements said that they would have. And it's that context, that kind of quid pro quo that happened between the European indentured servants and the elite wealthy class, mm-hmm. for lack of a better word, has been the problem in American society from the beginning, because we are still trying to play that relationship between the lower class whites
mm-hmm.
And the upper class is really at the heart of the problem. It's not, I mean, obviously their feelings about people of color is part of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think equal to that, if not more, is the class problem within whiteness that then comes over to impact mm-hmm. people of color as they kind of fight out, you know, their issues.
Yeah.
And it happened, and it shows very clearly the origins of that within the context of indentured servitude and how it was that poor whites had to depend upon these elites to be able to have the things in life aspirationally that they wanted to have. And part of that are some bargains that they had to make, you know, deals with the devil mm-hmm. that they gladly took and were frustrated by constantly, in the same way we see these frustrations break out over history and time, mm-hmm. including in today with, you know, January 6th and other moments. I mean, there's a mm-hmm. thousand of them. And I say that just kind of euphemistically, but there's lots of them where you see this white backlash, okay? White backlash that you hear so much about is really white people just being mad at the elites, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's often expressed at people of color, like oftentimes happens when you may have a lack of power in a situation. You don't go after the person who is hurting you. You go after other people, mm-hmm. you know, who, you know, are vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how that works. And just, you know, we can just have a whole history lesson just on that topic. But, you know, so, yeah. So it's just this the poorer class of whites, they had contracts that spelled out, you know, their servitude, that spelled out the conditions, the, you know, what they are fed, how long it would be, you know, what would happen if they you know, violated the terms of those conditions. But within that context was always the idea and the reality that they were accepted in society. They just were the lowest class. So although they may have had it rough, they may have been beaten, whipped, you know, treated badly, it never was like, but you're not going to be part of that society. You're not going to be white. You're going to, mm-hmm. you're going to always belong. It's just that you're just going to be the bottom of the barrel of this hierarchy. And they felt that. And yeah. In feeling that and feeling and knowing their own vulnerability is why you have part of this tense relationship between groups of whites and other people of color, because it's expressed within the context of what they know their vulnerability is to the larger society and seeing their place, you know, next to people of color and the vulnerability of that. So, you know, Du Bois talks about, you know, kind of this double consciousness. Mm-hmm. White people have a double consciousness too, because they, from a class standpoint, mm-hmm. they see themselves in relation to people of color, who may even be more wealthier than they, and then the elites. And okay, but if I'm white and I'm just regular working class, everyday people, and everything is telling me that this is what it means to be white, but when I see around me on a day-to-day level that what has been promised to me over time is not happening, you know, mm-hmm. because of, you know, capitalism, globalization, okay, these jobs that I used to have at GM and all these guarantees that I could have this job and nobody would come in and take it. And even during the slavery time, or right after abolishment of slavery, you know, the formerly enslaved can't take my job, they can't live in my neighborhood, and da-da-da-da, even though it was a poor section. Just this kind of vulnerability and seeing that the precariousness of their own privilege, you know, in display in between the people of color, black mm-hmm. people, and then the elite whites, is a lot of nervousness.
Yeah.
And that comes out.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, historically, from 1607 and even before, all the way up until today.
I mean, nothing has changed.
No, not much.
Not much. We have like fancy phones now.
Yeah, right.
Indoor plumbing.
right. And within the context of that is a whole history about race and class.
Facts.
Within that.
It's so weird, but nothing has changed.
Not a lot in that way. And so, you know, my book is a contribution to get people to kind of understand this system. And so, like I said, you know, when friends and family start, yeah, this is messed up, I had to do this and do that, and this is how that happened, I'm like, yeah, you know, it's designed to happen that way because, you know, we're in a capitalist society, which by definition is discriminatory. Then you mm-hmm. add race and gender and every other thing on top of that, you know, there's going to be problems, yep. you know, because their interest is about making money, period.
Period.
And so if your interest is about making money and I'm sick, what's going to happen at some point in that relationship, the money is going to overtake my care. What do you do as an individual? These are the kinds of things that happen in that. And so, and then instead of people, you know, coming together as they should, and many do see this. I mean, and many white people do. There's anti-whiteness groups, you know, all over. When I was at the University of Illinois, that right through the door, I was introduced to an anti-whiteness group that I kind of slid right into. And these were professors and graduate students and faculty who are a part of it. But many white people get it, you know. So mm-hmm. I'm not trying to make it seem like, okay, if you're white, you're automatically like this way. Because we see histories of that with abolitionists, white abolitionists, and white people helping black people mm-hmm. all throughout history. So, but it's really laying out to just say, we don't have to buy into this system. We can come together around our shared interest mm-hmm. as regular everyday working people. We don't have to buy into these notions of race and white supremacy. It's been used against all of us, and we all have fallen prey to it. And so if we can kind of see the game, mm-hmm. right, then we can then try to make a change and have a better society, which is my hope, is the ultimate goal. It's like, this is not innate. This is not kind of just the way it's supposed to be. This is something that's kind of been set up, and you don't necessarily read it until you kind of just step back a minute. But again, a lot of people do see it, but there's a large segment that don't. And so, and even for those who do, my contribution is to just kind of lay it out. And then I feel like then once people read it, it's like, you know what, this does make sense. I see this all the time. And then they're able to, you know, I see it as potentially being liberating in some ways to say, hey, now I know the game. I can, you know, at least see what's mm-hmm. happening and then try to do the best I can to affect change in my community.
Once you see it and you understand it, mm-hmm. hopefully folks are called to activate.
That's
and
what I'm
speak
hoping.
Up. And mm-hmm. I mean, this, when y'all read this, and I've been studying history for a very long time. Very excited. I was very excited to get my hands on this book. And it does lay out the beginning and really real pointedly explains these systems. And I knew these things and understood it, but it's definitely from a different angle than I have ever seen presented. And the sources, mm-hmm. how many sources did you tackle?
It was a lot. And thank you. Even my dissertation advisor, you know, David Roediger, The Wages of Whiteness, many of you know his work, which I consider him to be one of the fathers of critical whiteness studies, who I trained under. I mean, he's amazing. And we still talk. He was like, this is really impressive. So I really did. I was at the Library of Virginia, who has so many records. I mean, you wouldn't believe what this library has. I was there during the first Obama administration. Okay. And that's like a whole nother story being there. That was the year when, not the first administration, when he was running for office the first time. And that was the first time in Virginia that they had elected a Democratic president was Obama. Virginia did vote as a state. So that was a whole experience. But their records are so amazing that, yes, they have records back to like the 1620s. They have all the Civil War stuff. I mean, just the fact that they have like so much. And then from there, as a historian, you know, you look at the sources that are quoted in secondary sources. And then you go to those records and actually find them. Mm-hmm. And you just read and read and read. So, you know, I consider this book my life's work. And I did it during my dissertation. The sources for this book came from my dissertation, the base argument. But I, you know, when I wrote my dissertation, I was trying to say what I'm saying now, but I just couldn't quite say it. So I'm just like that student. It was just like, you're like almost there, but you're too young. You don't know, you know, mm-hmm. what you don't know. And so it was all there, and bless my committee's heart. They obviously saw it. But when I look back on it, it's like, this is what I was trying to say in my dissertation. But luckily I did a really good job, and I've gotten great advice from other graduate students that said, make your dissertation the very best that you can be, because when you're going to go back and write your book, you won't have to do as much work, right? You'll just be focusing on the ideas and not having to redo a bunch of stuff. And I did have to redo a lot, but the sources I didn't, because they were there and I did good work and spent the time. And so, you know, it came out of my dissertation work. But then, as you were saying, when I was teaching, I just could not write when teach at the same time. Some people do it. In fact, most people do. You know, part of just kind of self-awareness is just knowing, you know, what you can't do. Right.
I can't write and parent. I don't really do like any creative stuff and parenting at the same time. This is a no-go for me.
Me too. Me too. And I'm like, so I don't know how people do it, but most do.
Hats off to them.
But most do. And I'm just like, you know, I just can't do it. So part of that awareness then is just really realizing what is my place within the field of history and where I want to be. And that's when I kind of left the teaching part of academia and kind of became an independent scholar so that I could write, so that I can speak and lecture and do kind of the things that I want to do, kind of the fun part of being an academic. I often liken it to kind of, you know, being that fun aunt, you know, that I am, that I like to think I am, that, you know, we'll do all the fun stuff, right? We're going to go to the park and do this and stay up and all that. But the hard part, right, and that's what your parents do. Mm-hmm. This is kind of how I view teaching okay. in that. And I do love to teach. I feel like I am a good teacher. I feel like I have a lot to offer.
You're
I just
a fantastic try, teacher.
Thank you. I just have to do it another way. And the it's way fair. That I do it is through my writing, is through conferences, is through talks, is through other things like this, mm-hmm. that if I was teaching every day, you know, if I came to do this type of podcast, I'd be exhausted. I have a list of other things. I got papers to grade, emails mm-hmm. to answer, supporting students, you know, service work, you know, dealing with the politics of the university, which is a whole thing in and of itself. And part of even getting at white supremacy too, they're the proliferators, one mm-hmm. of the many, along with, you know, like we were talking religion and all these other institutions, schools have a place in yep. that as well. So, I mean, that's a lot on one individual. Mm-hmm. And like I said, you know, I just kind of just like, you know, you have to know, you know, what you can do effectively and where you want to fit in. Yeah. And I was able to make that decision. And I'm very proud of that fact. You know, as an individual and person that is like, hey, I know what I'm about and I know what I have to do. And it yeah. just makes kind of going through life easier.
Well, we have different seasons.
There you go. You know? There but, you go.
You did the classroom thing yeah, and you did it well. And
yeah.
now we get to engage with you in different ways. Still learning from you.
Still learning. And yeah. I do. I love, you know, being in the classroom itself was amazing and wonderful. And I learned so much. And, it's the outside of the classroom is really where it is. And that's yeah. a whole nother conversation. But
I can imagine the yeah. tests and the grading and all that would be, there's just a lot.
It is a lot. And like a lot of it is politics. Mm-hmm. It's departmental stuff. I mean, you know, it's a whole thing that has to move. And the faculty move it. Mm-hmm. The students provide the butts in the seats and the money. The money mm-hmm. comes with the students. And everything else that drives that engine comes from the faculty. Mm-hmm. And they expect you to help push it. And you have the administrative people that are kind of executing a lot of the stuff that comes from the students and the teachers. But so it's a beast.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't see kind of the other side of the academic world. It's a really huge thing that one of my friends that's a teacher said, If it wasn't for the fact you had to have students, this would be kind of a great little gig, you know, in the sense that it wasn't against the students, because the thing is so big and functioning that it's like it could almost operate without students.
Yeah.
That's how big and massive it is. And mm-hmm. that's why when students get on the college campuses, they're just kind of looking around and the world is just kind of speeding by. And, you know, you don't know that you need to talk to the registrar for this and this person for that and mm-hmm. that person for that. It's because this is a whole system and no one's like telling you. Like all these different steps, and by the time you figure it out, you're probably halfway through your education and waste tons of time where you could yeah. be studying and learning. Instead, you're just trying to figure out kind of the beast of the university and mm-hmm. how you're going to make that work for you. You know, yeah. it's crazy. So
it is,
but
this is what we've built, y'all.
It is what we've built.
This is what we keep building.
Keep building it. And it has a place and a role in society and in the making of American whiteness and kind of the functioning of these systems of oppression that happens. Mm-hmm. The university very much has a part to play in that. And that's a big contribution, what Black Studies is about and what mm-hmm. it has done historically, is point that out to people, that schools and the universities in particular are, you know, kind of, you know, right at the front lines of perpetuating and reinforcing inequality and, yeah. and white supremacy in society.
Mm. Facts. Mm. Facts on facts.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my other big questions for you today, in the book, you point out how enslaved folks are in the early part of all of this were pulling resources to buy freedom for mm-hmm. folks.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was such an interesting, like, it's an interesting point regarding this podcast, because it kind of touches on sharing mm-hmm. of the way that our community historically mm-hmm. has really ingrained sharing. And so I'm just curious your thoughts. I know this is kind of random, but how the making of American whiteness has drastically impacted our relationship with sharing.
Yeah, I mean, in a negative way, you know, the make of American whiteness then is about, you know, capitalism, which is about me and mine.
Yep.
Right. And I can have a zillion and you can have none. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. And so when you're in an environment like that, it doesn't take anything for you to kind of buy into that. I mean, earlier you mentioned, you know, our cell phones and gadgets. And then it was like, yeah, but, you know, what's behind that cell phone? Well, you got slave labor. Mm-hmm. You have digging in these mines, right, for the, I think it's coltan or whatever the mineral is. But you have to get that mineral out. You have, you know, poor working conditions, you know, and then you have, you know, okay, so it's really cheap to make this and who's making it and where, you know, the businesses behind it and how we get to that. And so we begin to see that within this context of wanting to have things and consumerism and capitalism coupled together then with this racial structure that we have, right? And we take that overseas and in these dealings and how we express, you know, kind of capitalism and white supremacy outside of the United States to get the resources and things we need to help the consumerism, not only within the United States, but around the world. That process then of wanting the things and being told, you know, what we wear, what we drive, you know, all of these things, you kind of become detached from the fact that, you know, no, it takes a community of people to come together to care for one another so that we can have the kind of society that we should have. You know, yes, we are each other's keeper. You know, we have to look out for our citizens and people and the environment and the ecology and animal world. I mean, that's what we have to do. But we see within the capitalist system, which is driven, you know, too, by white supremacy, and of course, you know, the slave trade is part of white supremacy and the capitalist system. Mm-hmm. When you see kind of this kind of accumulation of power and accumulation of wealth around people, around products, around making money, you know, people kind of get intoxicated with that and kind of, and, you know, get detached. And, you know, so that's the world we live in. That's the kind of water and we swim in, the air we breathe, you know, we all are touched by it. You know, we all like the things and the toys is, you know, but just to kind of be really aware of that, you know, and how does that inform your life? It does impact your ability to share. But once again, just like there's any whiteness and any racist groups out there, there's people out here who really understand the impact of the environment and consumerism has, even as they have to live within a consumer-driven society, even as they have to buy, you know, their cell phones and all these things too. It doesn't mean that you're not aware of the system and the politics behind it, and then try to live your life and inform your life in a way that is more sharing and giving, even within within that world. It's like a world within a world. Mm-hmm. So we have to be, you know, more mindful. And I think organizations like what you're doing and Equitable Giving and other organizations and you know, where the information is getting out, you know, I'm thinking of public radio and just kind of work that's happening all over that you see and that you can tap into. It's not hard if your eyes are open. College campuses, that's one thing I do love about college campuses, all my conversation. I love college campuses. I do, because that's where you really see kind of students and people just being activated. You know, you'll see somebody out there with a newspaper or a microphone and, you know, there's talks and things going on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't want people to think that I do not like college campuses. I love what is happening with the student driven things on the campus and even some of the faculty, because it's just kind of a natural space for that. And you don't really have to go looking for it. You know, you just kind of walk out across campus and you'll run into all kinds of things. That's the beauty of it. But those things are happening in everyday society too. Mm-hmm. And the work that you're doing, the work of other organizations, getting out the word so that people are able to make more informed choices and really kind of see our interconnectedness and how we have to work together to have the society, the community that we want to have mm-hmm. for ourselves and for future generations and current generations and people younger than us. I mean, I think that that's kind of how it happens. And so mm-hmm. you look at, just like I said, it comes down to understanding the system and the mm-hmm. structures within our society and how we're being played, how we're kind of part of that system, but we don't have to be kind of that. We can see it, you know, from a distance and try to do what we can to make a difference and even change it. You know, when we have the opportunity in our workplaces and in our communities and through our activities to kind of point these things out, and it first starts with an awareness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is that awareness when you really are being intentional and you see, like, not only you see it, but you hold that close to something mm-hmm. that you want to.
Yeah.
To bring along with you.
Yes.
It absolutely informs how we move.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And that's one thing I'm interested in.
Yeah. And it's really loud that, like, the making of America, right? Mm-hmm. Has absolutely disrupted so much of our natural existence, our community, the way that we build, the way that we function, our interpersonal relationships.
Totally. I mean, because it's designed to do that, because mm-hmm. if you have the interpersonal relationship, that connectedness, you won't have capitalism the way that it is, right? You won't have this racial structure the way that it is. I mean, all that goes together. If you start caring about people, then what's the use of race the way that it is now? What's the use of consumerism? Yeah. So all of these things allow power to stay in power. Mm-hmm. And so when, and that's why, you know, this type of sharing and thinking is a threat mm-hmm. to that type of system. Because, and so you can just look at what politicians are talking about. They're always talking about, you know, jobs and, you know, protecting borders and, you know, making sure we have this and that, making sure United States has the overabundance that we do have, right? Mm-hmm. And different from the rest of the world, right? In that way. And, you know, you can kind of debate about that, but the process of maintaining mm-hmm. what we have, not only of getting it from the beginning, you know, even before mm-hmm. the United States was formed, even before European settlement in Virginia in 1607, that trek from where we are now involves then a lot of not caring about people. Mm. And when you create all these structures about not caring about people, then the citizens, you know, part of this structure is they buy into it, mm-hmm. you know. Across racial lines, but particularly in the United States, you know, white supremacy and people that are white, you know, buy into it as well as people of color. Mm-hmm. And so when you kind of see the game, and I think it's an opportunity for people to kind of work together and see, okay, we're being used and we have to stop it. But when you see that, be prepared that our system doesn't do well with people who are not going along with the program. And there's backlash in that end as well. So there's a vested interest in maintaining this order. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of people that are interested and are doing the work every day, young and old, very, very young and old, to affecting change. And I think that's the beautiful part, and that's what gives me hope. And there's a lot of it out there. So although I'm talking about something that, you know, is inherently, you know, kind of negative, I don't necessarily see it that way in the sense it's like, okay, we're aware, we're opening up eyes, we can make a change. You just kind of have to know what you're dealing with so that you can make a change.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be using this book, The Making of American Whiteness, as one of my sources when we talk about sharing, because this is absolutely, you know, you talk about all of the ways that we've disrupted our humanity, our community in this book. And the way you lay it out is just so clear and thoughtful. Everybody, please go read this book. It's really fantastic. And also, just if you want more reading, once you read the book, the sources in here will keep you busy for a very long time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. So our next question is, do you have a question for me?
Wow. I mean, I guess one of the things that is, we've talked about it a little bit, but why is it that you decided to get involved and launch Equitable Giving Circle? Where does that come from for you?
I'd say it comes from a lot of places. I participated in a giving circle the year before we launched EGC, and I hated it. And I don't mean that in like a disrespectful way. I just was very, you know, I peeped what was happening, and it was a lot of white saviorism, and it wasn't, there was a lot of disconnects in terms of like what their goal and then how that was implemented. And how people experienced it. And I was just very much like, this is not the right space for me. Mm-hmm. You know, professionally, before we started at EGC, I was doing a lot of marketing and DEI and anti-racism consulting. Because those things are different. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want to be like a 9-to-5. Mm-hmm. Like I was really content with consulting. And we really started EGC originally as this after school project, right? Just a bunch of, I'd say mostly millennial professionals across the color line. We were going to do this thing and support Black women really in business, kind of around marketing. And that was like originally what we were talking about. COVID hit. We were like, well, I pitched to everybody like, hey, let's buy, you know, CSAs, community supported agriculture boxes from Black and brown farmers. We can give them away to Black and brown families, you know, as we were all watching COVID about to hit and what was happening. And we just knew that our community, the Black community, was going to be hit first and the hardest, and that it was going to have the most, you know, lasting impact. And we also were peeping how this was going to impact business and just, you know, the community as a whole. And when we launched it, we raised, I don't know, $30,000+ in a week. People really resonated with what we were talking about. And then it grew really fast into this, like, this whole organization. I was just joking the other day that EGC is one of the few things that I've committed to outside of my kid and dog, because I'm team like, I'm not committing. I don't want to, I'm not interested. I'd say Race Talks and Steps. I've been on those boards for quite some time now too. So I guess those are other long-term commitments for me. But it just, you know, it just made sense and all the pieces came together. For me, being able to do really intentional community work, like professionally, I've been doing development and marketing for 10+ years. And I love it, but I also hated it. Like I never really resonated using these skills for capitalism. Mm-hmm. At one point I was doing work with an engineering firm. And so it was really, even though it was capitalism, it was for people, mm-hmm. like bridges and airports and streetlights. So this kind of made sense in a very different way, where I get to use my development and my marketing skills for our community. And, you know, my degree is in African American history. And so being able to talk about that and extensively in a way that makes sense for me, because I'm not going to become a teacher. Mm-hmm. Maybe at some different date, I'll become a lawyer for some very other reasons. you know, so it just made sense. And I get to work with really incredible people who also are very passionate about community, changing systems. And, you know, now 3.5 years in, we are very much building things in a different way. We're really playing with, like, when we talk about reimagining, this is what it looks like. This is what it feels like. You know, being able to make sure that we're supporting our community with the very best. Something I talk about all the time, you know, in chattel slavery, enslaved people were given scraps, or they had to just figure out to make do. And sometimes folks were able to garden or, you know, hunt game or fish or whatever. But in general, this practice in terms of what people were served were given was literally the drudges, the leftovers, scraps. And so to be able to like help disrupt that in real time is really passionate, like really important and something I'm really passionate about. So with our whole team. And it also feels really good to serve the community that raised us, right?
Yes.
We're from Portland. We've all experienced some kind of need at a different stage of our lives. We get to serve people that, you know, we were in their classroom, we were in their after school program, or we cross paths, you know, we work with them or whatever. It's really empowering to get to give back in an intentional way and really carrying on the legacy of folks that raised us up and trained us. And so, like, that's a big why. You know, I'm a light bright from Portland. My family did not come from tons of money. My dad has absolutely tried to disrupt generational trauma and financially. I think that's been his biggest thing is to get over that hurdle. And so it's important for me to continue that legacy of disrupting and educating. And I grew up having these conversations because I am so bright that I would, one, I was peeping game because I was just like, this is a weird place to be seated. And all my siblings were all different colors. We're all different colors. So it's important to kind of carry that legacy and those lessons from a very early age, because I was, I would say when I was in grade school, it was just such a topic for me that came up that I wasn't white, but I wasn't like at the time I originally wasn't sure if I was black. My aunts were very much like, hi, you're bright. It's a thing. Move on.
Right.
You know, now I like to call it neon black, in very, you know, millennial style.
Right.
An 80s baby through and through. So that's kind of, you know, why. And EGC is growing rapidly. We're, our goal is to get into a building, and our goal is to continue to model this different type of care, our giving our community the very best, because it changes the way people interact, right? Like if they're served in thoughtful ways with the very, very best, it changes how they get to show up for themselves.
Right.
And it's really empowering. And it just, like, I would never want to serve somebody in my home or otherwise something that I wouldn't want.
Right.
Like I wouldn't give somebody a gift that I wouldn't be excited to have. I wouldn't, you know, bring people over and have serve them, you know, gross food or, you know, things that were old and moldy. So, you know, it's sort of this like coming together moment. And we are really trying to keep this work growing. And Portland is such a unique place to pilot this type of work because, you know, this is a place where we're teaching sustainability and urban development globally. Look at, you know, our universities and what their claims to fame are. And Portland being such a white place. It's only 6% black here and was an exclusionary state, as you know. This is such an interesting place to pilot these kinds of programs. And we're not working in silos by any means. There's so many other really incredible programming. And I want us to elevate and show other places because we can see the kind of results that we need for funding purposes and for, you know, for the data collection. Because we've, because of the way funding has operated for hundreds and hundreds of years and the intentional pulling of resources from our community, we often don't get to have the data points that prove what we're talking about in social service spaces. So I want to continue to push that and be a part of that change because it doesn't have to look like this. We can build things differently. We, as your book points out, we saw how they built systems very intentional for capitalism. We can build systems very intentionally for people.
Yes.
So that's sort of why and a little bit of how. And I'm, you know, still have a long time that I'll be working. So I'm very excited that I've now sort of found my lane in that's a really awesome. Purposeful way. Yeah. Because I definitely did not enjoy doing development work for capitalism. It's probably the snarkiest I've ever been when I was doing that. For real, it was just not, I never loved it. And I never saw myself getting into the nonprofit space. But this is, you know, kind of accidental, a divine intervention. And I love what we do. And I'm really excited to keep it going and growing. And Yeah, I want to see more community-based programs really get the funding and really get the opportunity to flourish. And mm-hmm. I'm absolutely obsessed with getting resources pumped into our community.
That's awesome. Yeah. We're lucky to have you.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel lucky to be in this space in more ways than one. And I definitely am blessed in like all of the different people that have helped train me mm-hmm. And, you know, enrich my mind and push me. Because mm-hmm. that's the other thing is I've been really lucky in my life experience to be pushed, to try new things, to be brave when I definitely didn't feel brave. Mm. And I like our work. We talk about this all the time, is a legacy of all of those who poured into us. And mm-hmm. we have a really dope team. And we all come to the table, you know, from slightly different places, but with the same, with liberation in mind, with community support, and just wanting something different. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Thanks. Yeah. I love what we do. I love what we get to do. And I'm excited for us to keep on going because Portland is the perfect place for us to continue to be, you know, showing what can be done and you know, the larger sense, help tilt the scale so that mm-hmm. we can see just really the returning of our resources. Yes. Can we start there?
Yeah, right.
Like, I'll take that. Like, you could just return our resources.
Right.
And I talk about that in context of returning our resources. It would really look different in terms of what our children can do. You know, just how we are able to be in community. Because mm-hmm. Our experiences are the way that they are because of the stolen resources mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and the intentional extraction of labor, land, you know, natural resources and beyond.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Well, I'm so glad to have called you one of my students. It's one of the reasons I'm so proud.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes. Well, I'm so honored that you're here, that you came and chatted with us today. I'm really excited for our listeners to just learn about, you know, you and your book. And I really hope you all read it because it is a phenomenal book. I've been telling everybody to read it. I've bought a couple copies to give away.
Thank you.
How can people buy the book?
You can get it from the publisher, which is Roman Littlefield. And then you can also get it from Amazon.
Okay.
Yeah, those are the two main places that you can get it. Other bookstores have it, but they're like really, really marking it up. So I would say those two places are the best.
Mm-hmm. It's worth every penny. Mm-hmm. So definitely buy it, share it with your friend after you read it, because you will love it. And again, the title is The Making of American Whiteness, The Formation of Race in the 17th Century Virginia. And it is truly a phenomenal book. And when you're done reading it, you'll have tons of sources to explore and to enrich your mind even more. Just as a regular plug, EGC, Equal Giving Circle, we are over at 42nd and Prescott. We have our free pantry for Black and Brown folks every Thursday from 10 to 2. If you need groceries, please come. We'd love to see you. If you are somebody of privilege, please make a donation. EquitableGivingCircle.org. We love to take your dollars and we put them to good use. We are trying to activate our housing program. And we just try to grow this work. So lots of donations make a really big difference in our work. Many hands move mountains. And truly, we're trying to grow our 615 recurring monthly donors. So please sign up. All dollar amounts add up. And if you haven't read the book Stone Soup, read that and you will understand what I'm talking about. And definitely please read this book. It will change the way that you understand our current systems, which is really impactful and important. And will probably make you activate. Because if you read it and you don't activate, you start over, read it again. You missed a couple pages. And our homework or action task for today, the thing that I would like for all of y'all to try is to talk to your immediate community, your intimate community, the folks you live with, your neighbors, the folks you work with, your friends, and talk about how you share and why. And really, you know, you could use the beginning questions that we ask at the podcast. What's your most favorite thing to share? What is something that's been really important that some other people have shared with you? What do you share the most? But really look at your own sharing practice and start dissecting it and discuss it with people. Because when you start to look at what you're sharing or why, first of all, you are going to realize that you're already good at it. You're already doing it. But you're going to also challenge yourself because you're going to realize there are spaces that you could be more thoughtful in your sharing. And there's going to be spaces where you can just are automatic, easy growth points. And so I want you to all really talk about it and ask other people about their sharing practices, because you're probably going to learn something really cool about the folks in your life as well. And with that, and again, say thank you so much, Dr. Carmen, for being here today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here. It's an honor.
Yes, I appreciate it. And thank you all for listening. I appreciate you. And I'm really grateful that we got to share with you today. Have a great day.